Hey, it's Brian. Back with another episode for those of us who just can't wait until the day after Thanksgiving to start the Christmas season. Now, if you're listening in real time, Thanksgiving is 1 week from today, so we're almost there. Of course, I'll be back on Thanksgiving to kick off another season of backstories to your favorite Christmas traditions and sharing your Christmas memories. Speaking of which, it's time to start sending them in. Today, I'm here to tide you over with one more preseason episode until we barrel in full steam ahead. Recently, I shared with you an interview I did with Thomas Ruiz Smith, a professor and the author of The Last Gift, a collection of Christmas stories by the 19th century author Mary Wilkins Freeman. Since then, I've been enjoying many of the stories from that collection on my own, so much so that I thought I'd share another one with you. Today, I'll be reading you The Christmas Sing in Our Village. This story first appeared in print in the Ladies' Home Journal in December of 1897. I'll be back at the end to wrap up and say goodbye. But for now, get comfy and cozy with me as we visit a village from a bygone era as they celebrate Christmas Eve in musical fashion. It's The Christmas Sing in Our Village by Mary Wilkins Freeman. The singing school is, of course, a regular institution in our village during the winter months, but the one of special interest is held on Christmas Eve. That is called, to distinguish it from the others, the Christmas Sing. On that night, only the psalms and fugues appropriate to the occasion are sung, and the town hall is trimmed with holly and evergreen. The sing begins at 8 o'clock and is always preceded by a turkey supper. The supper is in the tavern, as it used to be called. Now we say hotel. Still, it is the tavern, and always will be the same old house where the stages drew up before the railroad was built. The turkey supper is at 6 o'clock, and full 2 hours are required to dispose of the good things and speechify. Then the people cross the road to the town hall where the sing is held. It is a great occasion in our village, and the women give as much care to their costumes as if they were going to a ball. The dressmaker is hard worked for weeks before the sing. Everybody who can afford it has a new dress, and those who cannot have their old ones made over. The women all try to keep their costumes secret until the night of the sing, and the dressmaker is bound over by the most solemn promises not to reveal anything. The Christmas sing is often most brilliant and surprising to our humble tastes in the matter of dress, and was especially so last year. The sing of last year was also noteworthy in another respect. There were 3 betrothals and a runaway marriage that night. It was ideal weather for Christmas Eve and our sing, very cold and clear, a full moon, and a beautiful hard level of snow for sleighing. At 6 o'clock, everybody was assembled at the tavern. Past and present members of the singing school, even old man Veezy, who was over 90, were there. There were also some guests, fine singers from out of town. The turkey supper was excellent, and so were the speeches. One of the best made was by Mr. Cassius C. Dowell from East Langham, a village about 8 miles from ours. He is a very fine tenor singer and quite a celebrity. He sings in the church choir at Langham and is in great demand to sing at funerals. He is not very young, but fine-looking and a great favorite with the ladies. He has a gentle, deferential way of looking at them, which is considered very attractive. Lottie Green sat next to him at the supper table, and he looked at her and made sure that she had plenty of white meat and gravy. Mr. Lucius Downey was on the other side of Lottie, but she paid no attention to him. Had it not been for Lorinda Snell, who was next on his right, he might have felt slighted. She looked very well, too, in a fine new silk dress, plum color with velvet trimming. Lorinda was quite pretty in her youth, and sometimes dress and excitement seemed to revive something of her old beauty. Her cheeks were pink and her eyes bright. Her hair, which is still abundant, was most beautifully crimped. Lottie Green also looked very pretty. She had not been able to afford a new dress, but she made over her old blue cloth one and put in silk sleeves, and it was as good and quite as pretty as when it was new. Probably Maria Wright had the finest new dress of any of the girls. Everybody stared at Maria when she entered with a great rustle of silk and rattle of starched petticoats. The dress was of pink silk, and, a most startling innovation in our village, the waist was cut square and quite low. Maria has a beautiful neck and she wore a great bunch of pink roses on one shoulder. She had elbow sleeves too and drew off her long gloves with a very fine air when she sat down at the table. The other girls were half admiring, half scandalized. No such costume as that had ever been worn to our singing school before. Poor Zephyretta Stockwell, in a black silk which might have been worn appropriately by her grandmother, was entirely eclipsed by Maria in more senses than one. Jim Payne sat between the two girls at supper. Maria's pink skirt spread over her knee, her pretty face was tilted up in his, and her tongue was wagging every minute. Once I saw Jim try to speak to Zephyretta, but Maria was too quick for him. When supper was over, all the people assembled in the town hall without delay. The hall was finely decorated. Green wreaths hung in the windows, and the portrait of the gentleman who gave the townhouse to the village 50 years ago, Squire Ebenezer Adams, was draped with an American flag. It is a life-size portrait and hangs on the right of the stage. Our old singing master and choir leader, Mr. Orlando Sage, stood on the stage and conducted the school as usual. The piano was on his right. The South District teacher, Miss Elmira Crane, played that. There was old Joseph Nelson with his bass viol, which he used to play in the church choir, and Thomas Farr and Charlie Morris with their violins. The school was arranged in the usual manner, in the four divisions of sopranos, tenors, bassos, and altos. At 8 o'clock, Mr. Sage raised his baton and the music began. Everybody stood up and sang their best and loudest, with perhaps one exception. The result was quite magnificent, unless you happened to stand close to certain singers and did not sing loud enough yourself to drown them out. We went on with the fine old fugues, and it was grand, had it not been for the weakness in the sopranos. At length, Mr. Orlando Sage stood directly in front of the sopranos, waving his baton frantically, raising himself up on his toes and jerking his head as if in such ways he might stimulate them to greater volume of voice. Mr. Sage is a nervous little man. Finally, with an imperious switch of his baton and a stamp of his foot, he brought the whole school to a dead stop. "Miss Stockwell," he said, "why don't you sing?" Everybody stared at Zephyretta. She turned white, and then red, and then replied meekly that she was singing. "No, you are not singing," replied Mr. Sage. "I was riding past your father's yesterday, and I heard you sing. You have a voice. Why don't you sing?" Mr. Sage brandished his baton as if he would like to hit her with it, and poor Zephyretta looked almost frightened to death. "Why don't you sing?" sternly demanded Mr. Sage again. "You never sing in this school, as you can sing." Zephyretta looked as if she were going to cry. She opened her mouth as if to speak, but did not. Then suddenly, Lorinda Snell, who sat on her right, spoke for her. "I can tell you why, if you want to know, Mr. Sage," she said. "I haven't told a soul before, but much as 3 years ago, I heard Maria Rice tell Zephyretta not to sing so loud. She drowned her all out, and Zephyretta hasn't sung so loud since." When Lorinda stopped, with a defiant nod of her head, you could have heard a pin drop. Maria Rice, on the other side of Zephyretta, was blushing as pink as her dress. Then Mr. Sage brought his baton down. "Sing!" he shouted, and we all began again. When shepherds watch their flocks by night. Zephyretta did let out her voice a little more then, and we were all amazed. Nobody had dreamed that she could sing so well. Still, it was quite evident that she held her voice back somewhat on her high notes on account of Maria's feelings, though Maria would not sing at all during the rest of the evening. I think she was glad when the sing was over, though everybody else had enjoyed it. It was 10 o'clock when we closed, after singing When Marshaled on the Nightly Plain, and all the young men who had come with teams hastened out to get them. Many a young woman who had come to the sing with her father or brother went home in the sleigh of some gallant swain who was waiting for her when she emerged from the town hall. All the girls, when coming down the steps, ran a sort of gauntlet of love and jealousy between double lines of waiting beaux beyond whom the restive horses pranced with frequent flurries of bells. Then Maria Rice, to to the great delight of the vindictive of her sex and the amused pity of others, was seen after manifestly hurrying and lingering and peering with eagerly furtive eyes toward Jim Payne to gather up her pink silk skirts and go forlornly down the road with Lydia Wheelock, who lived her way. It was rumored that she wept all the way home in spite of Lydia's attempts to comfort her, but nobody ever knew. She was not far on the road before Jim Payne and Zephyretta passed her in Jim's sleigh, drawn by his fast black horse. Everybody was astonished to see Jim step out from the waiting file, accost Zephyretta, and lead her to his sleigh as if she had been a princess, and probably Zephyretta was the most astonished of all. Mr. Cassius C. Dowell, who had driven over from Langham, took Lottie Green home, and Mr. Lucius Downey escorted Lurinda Snell. He had brought a lantern, though it was bright moonlight. He is fond of carrying one because his eyes are poor. The lantern light shone full on Lorinda's face as she went proudly past on his arm, and she looked like a young girl. The next day, we heard that all three couples were going to be married, and that another very young couple, who had driven down the road at such a furious rate that everybody had hastened out of their way, and there had been narrow escapes from collisions, were married. They had driven 10 miles to Dover for that purpose, nobody ever knew why. The parents on either side would have given free consent to the match, but they drove to Dover that Christmas Eve as if a whole regiment of furious relatives were savagely charging at their backs. However, that marriage has been happy so far, and the others also. Jim and Zephyretta are a devoted pair. Lurinda Snell makes a good wife for Lucius Downey and does not talk as bitterly about her neighbors as was her unpleasant custom of doing formerly. Cassius C. Dowell seems very happy with Lottie, so the neighbors all say, and Lydia Wheelock, now that she has not Lottie and her children to look after and provide for, has bought herself a new parlor carpet and a bonnet. Take it all together, that sing seemed to our village to bring much happiness, set, as it were, to sweet Christmas music. Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. I, for one, have been listening to lots of sweet Christmas music over these last few weeks. I wonder if you have been too. It's one of my favorite ways to get into the spirit. Again, the story you just heard was from The Last Gift, a collection of Mary Wilkins Freeman's Christmas stories recently published by Thomas Ruiz Smith. Check the show notes for a link, and thanks again to Professor Smith for being part of this season of Christmas Past. Well, everyone, next time we meet, it'll be Thanksgiving Day and time to kick off an all-new season of Christmas Past, our 8th season. And as always, I want you to be part of it. Share a Christmas memory with the Christmas Past family this year. All you have to do is record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to me at christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Keep it reasonably short, clean, and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. I hope your Thanksgiving plans are coming together nicely and that you're ready to get cozy and festive for the season ahead. I'll see you soon. Until then, let me remind you that Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California, by yours truly, Brian Earle. Stay connected with me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Threads, and again, you can reach me anytime at christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Please do join our private Christmas Past Facebook group if you haven't yet. And hey, if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover this show? It's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker, and a handwritten Christmas card is my way of saying thanks. Reach out for details, and until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.